for the different color, but that's how they designated. But I find it far superior than the Home Depot product that they have there.
If in a pinch I bought the Home Depot product, which is not the 108, what's the major disadvantage? Doesn't stick as well?
Yes, correct.
Okay. So it's worth going to the extra effort to get the 107 for color, 108 for clear, and so on. The industrial grade. I mean, if you're going to use it at all, use the heavy-duty stuff. And from time to time, we would like to be able to buy a 55-gallon drum of industrial-grade holy water. Okay. Anyone else with any further questions or comments? Give me your call letters and name right now. Okay, it looks like Mel, we're ready for you to open up the mailbag. Did you get one or two emails this week, Mel?
Oh, yeah, just one or two. Anyhow, I guess one, two, or I guess three or four. Well, let's put it this way. Quite a number. One, let's see. Oh, did you want to go over to Paul and get the state report before we get involved? Because, you know, this usually gets the steps over.
Let's see if Paul's available. WS2N, are you on board tonight? Looks like we're going to have to wait 2 weeks for the next space report. You got it, Mel.
Okay. One of the first questions, again, very close to what we've been discussing about, you know, rust and all. This gentleman said how he got to us. Well, how he got to me, let's put it this way, from all places, from Ohio. This is really unusual. He wants to know how long you think guy wires on a tower should last. He's got a 65-foot tower, and his guy wires is up there around 20 years. He says, is there a rule of thumb for replacing the guy wires on a tower? Over.
Oh, that's a damn good subject. Been there, done that, lived with that. When I first moved into my current QTH, 1969. At the time, the cheapest, highest, the biggest bang for the dollar you could get out of guy wire was number 9 gauge galvanized sense wire sold in the Montgomery Ward catalog. So Montgomery Ward will tell you this guy wire, I think it was 500 foot rolls, 250 foot rolls. Very cheap price. It was intended for fence wire. In other words, this is the kind of wire they used out in rural areas for fencing in cattle or whatever. That's the good news. The bad news is the stuff only had a light coating of galvanized, which was electroplated on, and it would start showing rust in about 5 years. And by the time 10 years came along, the guy wire started looking so rusty, he got scared and he replaced it. Then I started getting smart, and I said, hey, the price of the wire is not what counts. It's the quality of the wire that counts, because my life depends on it. When you've got 100 feet of power, and if one of those guy wires breaks and the tower falls down, it's going to make your life complicated. You really don't want that to happen. So I started using industrial grade 6M guy wire. 6M is the stuff you get out of the Graybar catalog, among other suppliers, but Graybar is a very good supplier. This is hot dip galvanized 7-strand guy wire. They call it 6M. Because I think it's good for 6,650 pounds, ultimate strength. 6M means 6,000. A little bit on the heavy side. And I think there's also, that's quarter inch that I use, quarter inch diameter. I believe there is a 3/8 inch version of it. Yes, there is a 3/8 version, which is a lot more rare. That particular guy wire, because it's hot tip galvanized, I know it's usable for approximately 25 years. So if you buy the right guy wire, treat it properly. In other words, you don't bring the guy wire into hardware that is not galvanized. Nice thing about galvanizing is that it's automatically rust-proof the steel underneath. And the steel underneath is called EHS, extremely high strength. That's how a piece of guy wire is so light and thin. It's got 6,650 pounds of strength to it. And so a tree could fall against that guy wire. It has happened on my property. a massive tree fell against the guy wire, and the guy wire didn't break. It stretched. I guess that particular guy wire is about 130 feet long, and that guy wire became 2.5 feet longer. Scared me. With block and tackle, I removed the tree from the guy wire, and now the guy wire is loose. Not because it had flipped at the end, but because it had stretched. It didn't break, it stretched permanently. I replaced it, of course. A guy wire that's been through a stress like that, you don't want to do that more than once. So, the hot dip galvanizing you get with a Roan tower is rated for normally 25 years, after which the galvanizing slowly erodes away, and you start getting rust on the tower. But you've got to do some good things to make that happen. In the case of a tower, do not connect ordinary steel U-bolts to it, because the U-bolts will start rusting, and the galvanizing on your tower will sacrifice itself. It'll slowly migrate over to the rusting U-bolt, and you're literally removing the galvanizing of your tower in that local area. You talk to any tower expert, any man who owns a tower and cares about it, they'll tell you nothing but galvanized or stainless steel hardware is going to come into direct contact with that tower during the time that I own it. He'll say words like that. So the tower itself is good for 25 years. Guy wire, you could stretch it to 25 years if it is quality guy wire. And when it comes to replacing guy wire, there's an art and a science to doing that. You put the new guy wire on first before you remove the old one. There are foolish people who will remove the old guy wire and say, hey, I got a lot of them there. Don't worry about it. I'll just leave that one off while I put a new one on. Very dangerous procedure. Don't do that. The low bidder who did that for the tower out in Poland, which was the tallest structure on the earth, 2,250 feet tall, Radio 1 in Poland, in Plock, Poland, used to have the tallest tower. And the low bidder replaced the guy wires that were rusting. They had been up for like 35 years or so. And they disconnected too many of them at once, and the whole darn tower collapsed, and some people died, and local community lost the faith and wouldn't allow Radio 1 to put that tower back up in that community. So, don't skimp on guy wire. Buy quality. And worry about how long the guy wire has been around. If the roll of guy wire you're buying is on sale because it's been sitting in someone's basement in the pool of water for 10 years before you buy it, some of its aging has already taken place, in my opinion. So don't skimp on guy wire dollars. Buy the quality, make sure it's got good galvanizing, and you're good for 25 years. Buy the cheap stuff like I used to, number 9 gauge galvanized fence wire, and it starts showing rusting in 5 years. And within 10 years, you're going to definitely want to replace it. And so, with a little bit of an investment up front, you will own the tower rather than the tower own you, where you have to keep doing maintenance on it all the time. That's false economy. Those are some of my opinions on that subject, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW in the tech net.
Okay, well, let's talk about, location also. I replaced the guy wire last year on my tower. the cost of new material guy wire has gone up like considerably from what you mentioned, Dick. And I use 5/16 guy wire. This is the stuff that is used by a number of these different companies that install poles, and they swear by it. They also, when you say where it goes to the tower, some years ago, one of the power expert, so-called, he told me that when they were installing commercial towers, they used this U, in other words, the welded on, eye on the tower. You don't pass, he says, the cable through into that eye and then put it to the clamp. He says you use this, it looks like I got them, copy U, that's the only way I can describe them. Made out of copy, slip the wire through, and then it goes through the tower. And it supposedly, because it's copper, it will, the movement of it, it won't wear through that the welded ring on the tower, and I don't know, some other stuff. And also, the cable also won't chafe the cable or whatever. Now, I use those used. I have them up on the tower. Did you ever hear of that, Dick? Over.
Okay. The product that I wrap the wire into is called a thimble. It's a U-shaped thimble. In other words, picture what would happen if you took a piece of tubing and sliced it the long direction. So you've got half of the piece of tubing there in the long direction. And then you bent that into a new shape. That's what these thimbles look like, and they're made out of galvanized steel. And you, whenever the guy wire is going to go through the eye of a eye bolt or of a one of these adjustable things, can't think of the name of it right now. Why can't I think of the name of the adjustable object?
ENJ with a comment.
Turnbuckle.
Turnbuckle. That's the right word, turnbuckle. So when you go through a turnbuckle, you make sure you go through a thimble first. That way, two or three kinds of protection are taking place. Guy wire will give you full strength if and only if it's out straight. When you make it into a sharp bend, that becomes a stress concentration point. Also, the guy wire is going to rock back and forth on your adjustable object, and as such, chafing will take place. So you want to put it through a thimble first. And I think the thimble should be made out of galvanized steel. Yes, you could make it out of copper, and the good news about the copper is that it's a softer material, a little bit more malleable, and a little bit, mechanically, it's a little bit more friendly to the guy wire. But now you've got dissimilar metals. You've got steel, galvanized, and copper. And if I go to my galvanic series, I'm not convinced that that is considered a compatible setup. I'm a little bit worried that the galvanizing, again, will be sacrificing itself to the copper. Mr. PNJ, I think, had a comment on that one. Go ahead.
You said it all for me. Thank you.
Yeah. I'm afraid of a copper thimble. I think it should be a galvanized, hot tip galvanized thimble. Is there anyone else who want to make a comment on that one? And I'm a strong believer in the guy clips. The things that look like U-bolts with a U-saddle, again, galvanized, hot tip galvanized steel. And three of those minimum at each point of connection, where the guy wire goes through the thimble, through the turnbuckle, loops back, and then three guy thimbles. There is something called a fast assembly guy dead end. In other words, it's a Chinese finger torture-like object that you can slip the guy wire into. Yes, it's a faster installation. However, a number of towers have fallen down because those things mysteriously disconnect from time to time. There's a tiny little 5-cent clip that's supposed to be on the end of that thing. And everyone says, why bother putting that thing on? Well, that thing makes the difference between life and death. When ice on a winter day comes sliding down your tower, and it hits that Chinese finger torture object at the bottom, called the fast connect guy dead end, it will separate the fingers of the finger torture object, and the guy wire goes loose, and the tower falls down. And a number of towers in North Carolina one day fell down during an ice storm because of those things improperly being installed. And if you insist on using one of those, then do put a guy clip on top of it, forcing the Chinese finger torture to be very tightly bound with your guy wire. In that case, I'd sort of trust it. But if you're going to put guy clips anyhow, go the whole way and loop back. You get the full strength of the guy wire that way. So I'm strongly not in favor of those. McKay Radio out in Hopog had these six towers, each 100 foot tall, made out of Rhone 45, very sturdy stuff, held up with, I think it was either 3/8 or half inch guy wire that had these guy dead ends at the end. And mysteriously, those would come apart periodically. Their tower rigger man one day was lowering one of those towers. They were pivoted from the bottom with a winch that was held together with one of those dead end objects. And when that dead-end object let loose, and there was around 20,000 pounds of force on that particular piece of guy wire, the stretch of the guy wire, which is a kind of a spring, came zipping back toward him, a piece of guy wire that was probably 130 feet long, came zipping back toward him, hit him in the shoulder, and broke his shoulder. And he has permanent damage from that. So you can see there's a number of reasons why I don't trust them. Barry Into MB and I were at that exact same installation way back in 1985-86 when it was being dismantled, and we had used that exact same winch to lower that exact same tower where the guy had been damaged, and we had lowered it down to the ground where the tower was tilted above the ground by about a 5-degree angle, and we left it that way one night as we were disassembling the tower. Barry came back early the next day, walked up that tower, being held up by this very tight piece of guy wire, about 20,000 pounds of force on it, walked up the tower and took a look at the antenna at the end, walked back down, was standing on the ground, and all of a sudden that guy dead end let go, and the tower fell to the ground. Had that happened with Barry being there, there's a medium good chance he could have been heavily damaged. A piece of guy wire whipping across the property because it suddenly let loose with a lot of tension on it can slice through a human being. It happens periodically on the arresting wires that are used on carrier decks for an aircraft carrier. If one of those wires breaks and you're standing on that deck and that wire comes whipping toward you, it can literally slice through a human being. So do worry about those things. Some of the most dangerous things you can do on a radio tower is to improperly install guy wires so that they don't have integrity for the right length of time, don't have the right kind of hardware on the end, or while you're assembling the tower, drop the tower section. If on the way down the tower section you drop happens to cut through a guy wire, it can collapse the whole tower with you on it. It'll definitely get your attention. A good engineer looks at all the possibilities of what's called worst case engineering and makes sure that he has done some kind of protection to prevent that eventuality. That's what a smart engineer does, in my opinion. K2KEY, KQRIW in TechNet.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Well, my experience being here, right here at the ocean, only a couple hundred feet off the ocean, I pulled out the old guy wires, you know, with those copper, has those copper symbols, and the wire, that was the only part of the wire that looked good. That was inside the thimble. The rest of it was real miserably looking, rusty, so rusty that when you bend the wire, you could actually feel it just, I don't know, breaking. Now, when I put the new guy wire up, somebody had told me, one of these guys said, you know, he says, you can preserve it a lot. I'll tell you what to do. You make a hand trough. Now, listen to this. You make a hand trough, and you fill it with this Rust-Oleum product, I believe it was. It's aluminum product made by Krylon or somebody. It's a rust inhibitor. You stretch the guy wire between two points. And as you're walking along, and say you have your right hand riding along the guy wire, holding this sort of homemade trough, that you use a glove, an old glove, and then like a piece of rag inside of it. In other words, so your thumb and forefinger, they form around the guy wire, and then your pinky does the same thing around the other side, and in the middle is like the trough. And as you're going along, you keep pouring a little bit more of this stuff onto that glove, and it coats the guy wire. And I did that, and I take a look at the guy wire, because I know they used to turn, you know, right away, get this brownish, ugly, rusty look here, I guess they by the ocean fairly quick, even though I think they still were in really good shape. I put this on there, and Dick, would you believe now, if you look at them a year later, they're still shiny, Dick, over.
Okay, I got a couple of questions, Mel. What brand name of guy wire? What I think you said 516, which is pretty heavy. Quarter inch to me is 6,000-pound test. 516 must be 8,000-pound test guy wire. So what brand of guy wire? Was it hot dip galvanized? And the Rust-Oleum product that you made this trough out of, what was the name and model number and price? Does it come in a can? The Rust-Oleum product that you coated it with sounds like the right way to go, Mel. I know that there are some very exotic rust-converting pieces of chemistry these days that you can coat steel with and really protect it from rust very well. I used to use zinc-rich paint, but I think there's even better products now. And when it comes to products that are made to stick to galvanizing, there are very few paints that will properly stick to galvanizing without a special galvanizing primer. So this material you're using, was it specifically made for galvanized?
Ian, do you want to comment?
PNJ, we'll get to you in a second right after Mel. Mel first, go ahead.
Okay, now, the guy was, stuff I got was actually meant for winches. It's 516 and goes on to a drum. And, the roll of it weighed a lot. It was heavy. Oh, yes. Quite a bit of weight there, boy. You know, you're thinking of pull on the tower with that, just the weight of the guy wire. And the stuff that I used, oh, God, it had a funny name to it. I believe it's a Krylon product. And it's meant, yeah, it's meant to galvanize nice and shiny. That's basically what it is. What do you call it? Now I got to think for a while. You know, I may have the can around someplace. But I did this. I went along that guy wire before I installed it, like I say, stretched between two points, and I coated it. I just, you know, let it flow on there, rubbed it in, you know, rubbed it, just moved it along like a trough, and just soaked it in. And then I let it dry, and I was amazed. It still looks terrific, because usually, within a short time, it starts to look pretty miserable here by the ocean deck over.
Yeah, when I do a guy wire installation, you're using pliers and other things to bend the guy wire in the right position, tightening on these guy clips, and the tightening process of the guy clip is chipping away some of the galvanizing. When I'm through with that installation, I spray the whole thing with Rust-Oleum zinc-rich paint. Let's see what Bob's got to say. I bet he's got some good suggestions on this. W2BNJ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, W2PNJ here. What I've found that covers galvanized pipe and it doesn't peel, but you can't buy it anymore, so what's the sense? But it's white lead paint. Paint that's a primer that's rich in lead, and I believe you can't buy it anymore, but it works excellent. I have a little bit left, and when I have a piece of conduit or something that I want to use in a, you know, like my fellow worked for me, he did his mass service and wanted to match the house. He primed it with this primer. I gave it to him, and he was able to put his house paint on top of it. It's been up there 5-6 years and hasn't peeled at all.
Bob, when you use white lead paint on galvanized material, what's your guess as to the longevity of that? 10 or 15 years at least?
Yeah, at least.
Even though we're trying very desperately to remove all lead from the environment, for specific applications, I'd like to believe some specialty house somewhere will sell a lead-bearing paint. What do you think, Bob?
I don't think you can get it. Not as a consumer. I don't think it's available to us. The paint that I have a couple of Sherwin-Williams. And it's, you know, years ago when I was a kid in the city, and you'd always see the wrought iron fences primed. The rust spots were always primed with red lead paint, and then they would wind up painting it over in black. But that was on rust, which worked very well on that. But it worked excellent, and that's why I bought it some years back. I asked the guy in the store, and he said, "No, this is excellent for painting over galvanized product."
Yeah, I have heard that there are some rust-converted paints these days. In other words, you chip away as much as you can with a wire brush, and then there are these paints that will adhere to the rust, convert it to a more friendly material, and protect the metal underneath and act as a primer. Rust-converting paint, I think some of them are epoxy-like substances. This paint of yours, Mel, what's your guess? Did it cure in, say, a few hours like ordinary paint, or is it something that stays pliable for a long period of time? K2KEY, K2RIW.
K2KEY. No, it was dry fairly quick. That's why I think it may have been like a zinc chromate type of product. You can't get anything with lead. I had asked, because I know that from way back, that the lead base, the red lead and all that kind of stuff that they used was excellent, but no way. It's out of the environment, period. You literally, I'm surprised they didn't commit automobile batteries with lead plates. I mean, that's really the last stand. You will not find lead anywhere. They used to put the lead, you know, even up on the roof, they used to use the lead paneling and all that on domes and things like that. But that lead, sheets of lead used to last, I guess, literally indefinitely, but you can't use that anymore, so now they're using copper. Now, as far as, yes, I did go back, you know, when I tightened all those clamps back up and everything like that. I took the stuff and smeared it back onto it and all to protect those, you know, areas. And see now how long the guy has been fired last. It is a cost, I'll tell you something. The price has gone phenomenally high to buy good quality, you know, guy wire material, Dick. It's really outrageous now. And, I mean, you know, it's at a point now that, you know, people will think twice before replacing it. So I think maybe the best idea is if I, let's say now, for argument's sake, if I see it start to turn in a few years, you know, start to get that somewhat of a discoloring again, feeling that maybe the stuff is starting to wear away, maybe I could take those guy wires just down one at a time and recoat it. I would, that wouldn't be such a big deal because maybe I can wash it down with, you know, some thinners or something. You know, just run it over a wet thinner, a rag of thinners, and then put this coat back on. And I would say maybe I could preserve the guy wires rather than have to go through the work is one thing, but like I say, the cost is really gone extremely high, and I was really flabbergasted at what 500 feet of that guy cable cost me over.
Now, in my opinion, Mel, 5/16 is a lot more than you need. A quarter inch would be more than enough, and I think 3/16 would have done it in your case. I believe your towers are in the vicinity of 45 feet tall. I'm a little curious as to why you felt you needed 5/16, which I think is around 8,000-pound test. And yes, that is a rare guy wire, very heavy, in pounds per foot. And normally that's used on a 250-foot high tower. So what made you go that thick on guy wire, Mel? Go ahead.
Okay, the tower is 85 feet, not 45, it's 85 feet tall. And the price was right. You know him. And I got the right. I priced, I could say, quarter inch. The quarter inch was standard. They had 3/16 quarter inch, and I got the 5/16 for the same price. I mean, this was a good deal, so I took it because, in fact, I think the quarter inch cable, if I'm not mistaken, was more money because, you know, this was a real lot, Dick, and so the guy gave it to me at a very good deal. But you go, he was handling industrial cable and, believe it or not, rope. All kinds of rope for especially marine use and all. It's woven all kinds of, nylon rope, I guess. And even look at the price of rope, I was flabbergasted, Dick, over.
Yeah, my favorite kind of rope is braided nylon, which, when you buy the exotic version of it, it's used for mountaineering work. It's called Kern mantle rope, K-E-R-N mantle rope. And it's got a bunch of linear fibers of nylon down the center, and it's got a sheath on the outside of tightly woven braided nylon. And that rope is very soft to the touch, very flexible, very strong. Now, you've got another option here, Red Mel. Rather than take the guy wires down, which is a big job, when you're on your tower, you can reach down 3, 4, 5 feet on each guy wire. So maintaining the ends of the guy wire and all of the hardware on the end from the tower, that's easy. The only thing you got to get is access to the wire that's in between that point and the ground. I think you could make a trolley car mechanism that wheels itself along the guy wire, and it's got a rag-like substance wrapped around the guy wire that's in the trough of this material, and there's some kind of rubber bands or whatever around the rag so it presses tightly against the guy wire, and you wheel that trolley up and down the guy wire while standing on the ground or standing on the tower, whichever way you want to do it. You could do it by being up on the tower with a counterweight pulling it down. And so I think you could coat your guy wires without removing it from the tower. You're a guy that's crafty enough to be able to do that. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yeah, I guess maybe some way you can do some kind of rig up, you know, with ropes and things and all, but how do I get over the insulators that break up the guy wires, Dick, over?
Oh, didn't know you had those. And I'll bet you some of those egg insulators you got there, Mel, you may not have needed, might not have needed them. As long as the guy wire itself is not a resonant length at your particular frequency, and even if it is, you can kill that resonance by putting another wire off to one side, you know, put a T-bone wire on it somewhere, and you can kill the resonance. So there's a hell of a lot of places where people use egg insulators, and they're not really needed. Were you lighting up your whole tower as a broadcast tower, so to speak, AM broadcast?
I don't know, really. I guess I was a bit of a novice when I first put up the tower. You know, I spoke to a lot of so-called mavens on tower. Oh, you better break up those guy wires. All kinds of reasons they gave me for it. So I broke them up with a forgot different, you know, each one variable different lengths between the insulators. And, you know, those insulators, when I bought them, they weren't cheap either. Those are heavy, that they say insulators, you know, these egg insulators. So it took a lot more, you know, a lot more clamps even to put extra clamps. And all that hardware and everything and, you know, all that stuff added up to a considerable amount of money, Dick, over.
Yeah, I own some egg insulators that were used in a commercial installation of a tower. And these egg insulators are porcelain with a brown surface. I think they're approximately 7 inches long, approximately 3 inches in diameter. And they look to me like they're made for 3/8 diameter guy wire. And it looks to me like they're made for 8-10,000 pound holding strength. And I remember giving one of those to a friend once as a gift. That's an egg insulator. I also own some Rhone 45 towers that I've acquired over the years, and I'm dreaming about the day I'll put that up. I think Rhone 45 tower is dackable to something like 850 feet. We can dream, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW. Go ahead with your next email if you want to.
Okay. 850 feet. Okay. You dream about that. I will take a look at it. I won't climb it, but I'll take a look at it. Yeah, the egg insulators, not those are the large ones. I know I've seen them. They use them on a lot of the, you know, pullback utility poles that the, you know, the last utility pole that Edison has here, these wooden poles. So they sometimes actually have to counterbalance the last pole. So they have like another pole across the street, and they got like a backstay, and they put these egg insulators, big ones, on there. Now, they break it up two places. I would assume there must be some kind of a safety reason that they have to put on a wooden pole where there's no power cable going to it. I see they install those insulators, Dick, over.
Yeah, most power distribution systems in a community have an upper wire that connects to nothing, which I call the lightning arrestor. And that is grounded at each individual pole by having a piece of six gauge solid copper wire going down the side of the pole, and it connects to the metal plate, a copper metal plate on the bottom of the pole, which is called the butt plate. And at the time they install the pole, that plate is installed. Well, unfortunately, there's a significant number of communities where some enterprising individual decides to strip away the six gauge piece of copper wire going down the side of the pole, and he sells it for scrap. He gets a couple of dollars for it, and he puts everybody in the community at risk. That's crazy. That's the grounding system on each individual pole for both the pole pig transformer and also for the lightning arrestor wire that's on the top of the pole. You want this grounded wire on the top of the pole to be struck with lightning before your three phases are struck. And that way, there's a high probability you limit that huge voltage surge that'll come into your house that'll damage your equipment. And all of us who worry about a lightning strike to our radio tower installation, you'll discover that 90-some-odd% of the time, when lightning strikes your community, it hits the power line, comes into your house that way. It's not coming in by way of your radio antennas, because that power distribution system is a much huger target for it to hit, even though you think it's not as high as your radio tower. Okay, go to the next email if you want to, Mel, K2RIW.
Now, one final question on that. Now, you have a pole, a wooden pole, and they got to, like I say, counterbalance that wooden pole. It's the last one, you know, with the power lines on it, so it has a lot of drag on it, so it should start to bend. Now, they run a guy wire off that pole, and they bring the guy wire many times across the street, and they got these insulators in that guy wire holding that pole. And it goes to another pole, of course, to keep it up overhead. Now, the backstay that holds the second pole that this thing is guided to, now they got to backstay that down to the ground to hold that, you know, pole also, in other words, they complete it. Why they got to put insulators into that line, too, Dick Goldberg?
Let me first ask, where is that insulator? Is that insulator close to the ground or close to the top of the pole?
They're close to the top of the pole. In other words, what they have on the pole, I see the wood pole, one right here down the block. They got this wood pole that's, I could say, the support pole for the guy wire that's holding the pole from across the street. There's a couple insulators from that guy cable coming across the street. It comes to this pole, they drew right through this pole, and they got this, like, double ring. It's, a rod, a heavy, good heavy rod, galvanized rod, goes right through the pole. And the other side, they got this eye that they screwed onto it, so it's got an eye on each side. Now, the cable that's coming down from that point, or maybe about a foot from that eye, this backstay eye, they got an insulator. Then they got another insulator further down, and before they put the shell on there, I guess, so you walk into it, you don't slice yourself up or whatever. You know, so maybe you can see it easier. You know, this is like this half metal shield that clamps onto that cable just before it goes into the ground. You know, and it extends up about maybe 10 feet, Dick, over.
I've got a guess as to why that's there, Mel. First of all, that wire going across the street to the pole that's doing the back guying, I call that a gin pole. In the worst case scenario, one of your three phases of 7,800 volts that's on the main poles might come in contact with that backstay guy wire. If so, with the egg insulator near the top of that guy wire that's slanting down to the ground at a 45-degree angle, that egg insulator protects the people on the ground. If you didn't do that and you had a worst-case accident, somebody hits a pole down the street and one of the three phases of 7,800 volts touches one of those upper wires, it could be communicated all the way down to the guy wire going across the street, to the gin pole, and down to your shielded piece of wire, the wire that's got the metal shield on it. The thing looks like a fender from a bicycle, so to speak. So I think those egg insulators are secondary protection to make sure that that wire can't possibly become live. Because if it did, first of all, not only is it conducting current to ground, but a person coming along touching that assembly could become electrocuted. That's my guess, Mel. Go ahead.
But the wire coming across the street, that guy wire coming across the street before that gin pole, that backstay, is got insulators in it also. In other words, what possibility, how could it get across those insulators coming across the street? They got a couple of them on there, that cable. And you should see the way they put the cable. You know, they don't use clamps. That's another thing. They weave the steel cable that's stranded the guy wire against. They weave it together in such a manner, Dick. I've never seen one come apart. No clamps, over.
In other words, are you telling me that two pieces of guy wire come together end to end, and they weave that junction? Is that what you're saying?
Oh, no. Like, for instance, the eye, you know, where it comes through the eye, they fold it back, and you would think you put a clamp right to hold the guy wire from that. I've never seen that. Edison all has a way of braiding it together. Some way of braiding the guy wire together. Never seen a clamp on it. Just like some kind of twisting way. Never saw one come apart, Dick, over.
Okay, that's called a guy dead end. In other words, that object that goes through the turnbuckle or through the screw eye is a U-shaped... No. It is a assembly... That's the best way I can describe it now. Yes, it's an assembly where it's got a 180-degree bend in the middle of the assembly. The assembly is made out of seven strands, maybe six strands. It's made out of six strands. Where the six strands fold back on themselves, they are woven over top of the real piece of guy wire that's going to the ground. The piece of guy wire going to the ground goes straight through that assembly, and the individual strands of that guy dead end weave around it. That's the guy dead end assembly I'm talking about. It's a very fast installation, that's the good news. And when you use it on the top-down scenario, in other words, it's up high and the guy wire is going down, it's a reasonably safe installation. When it's used in the reverse manner, without using that clip on the end of it that caps off the junction of the, I call it the Chinese finger torture thing, what caps off the end of it where you end and the guy wire begins, there's a fancy metal clip that has to be over that end. It's a 5-cent piece of steel. And if you don't leave that off, ice sliding down the guy wire can separate the whole assembly. That's the guy dead end. The woven thing you're describing is the guy dead end. You go to a gray bar catalog and you look up the word guy dead end, you'll see a picture of that. Or you can also look in your Rowan Tower catalog and you'll see that thing described in photographs or in a line drawing. Back to you, Mel.
Hey, very, very good. I guess properly installed, like you say, they are very reliable. If I see them all over the place, you know, wherever Edison has any of these guy cables, I've always looked at that and I say, how the heck they keep it so goddamn tight or whatever that you never see one flip apart. Okay, very good. I guess we sort of covered the guy wire really in depth tonight. You ready for another one? I'll dig out some... see what we got in interest tonight, Dick, over.
22HWW with a comment for the net.
Fire away, Mel, but Howie first. Go ahead, Howie. And Howie, you hand it over to Mel.
Okay, just want to let you know, Dick, I got those filters, those two-fold crystal filter from the company down in Florida for 10 meters, and I must report it has solved all interlock problems, and I'm amazed that with about 2.5 to 3 dB of insertion loss, no degradation in sensitivity, but what a difference between night and day as far as the noise floor and getting rid of all of out of band crap. Just want to let you know, these filters are everything they say plus more. Let me give it over to Mel, and or if you want to comment, Dick, WD2HWW.
Sounds like another success story. Well done, Mel. I mean, Howie. So when it comes to single site, 2-meter repeaters, or even a dual site, you want to make sure your receiver has got a real good filter and only the right frequency gets through. This crystal filter does the job. Tell us the brand name and the dollars, and then pass it over to Mel.
It's a company in Florida. I think it's called Entime. Oh, no, Piezo something. Actually, Richie knows because he actually got it for me in 2EO, and it's not for 2 meters. I don't think you would want to use a crystal filter on 2 because of the insertion loss, but at 10 meters, it totally got rid of all the out-of-band CB noise and all of the noise. The receiver doesn't go crazy. $300, the thing is about the size, half the size of a pack of cigarettes. It's about the length of a pack of cigarettes, and it has two SO239. The only bad thing is you better not transmit through it, or you will blow it up. Excellent. Signal that you can put into one of these things is plus 5 dBm at resonant frequency. Two-pole filters. Apparently there's a coil and a capacitor in there for, you know, impedance matching. But I must say, it is like a brick wall filter. I mean, it's tight. It's looking like looking through a pinhole. All I must say is, it took about 8 weeks for them to make this. I don't know why. Apparently they grow the crystals or they get them made, and they have to be precisely put on frequency. But it's like an IF strip in front of your front end. It's amazing how well these things work, Dick.
Howie, do they supply you with a data sheet that's got a curve on it as to what the performance of your particular one is?
No, but I spoke to the guy who did it, and he told me that at FFO it was about 2.8 dBs, and at 100, plus or minus 100 kcs it was down 40 dBs. At plus or minus 20 kilohertz, it's down about 12 dB. So if you run a regular narrowband FM signal through it, if the guy is too wide, it starts to attenuate. It's almost like having a real tight IF filter. One thing that they caution is you better not drop these things because they're delicate. He said they won't get bothered too much by too much static electricity as long as you don't have a lot of it. So I have a quarter wave stub and a gas discharge tube in front of it. When the feed line comes in, the antenna is basically a DC grounded feed antenna, comes in, goes through a gas discharge tube, and then it goes into a T-connector with a quarter wave stub, short into one end. So hopefully I have enough protection on the front end of this filter. But I have to say, what amazing job. It just basically, that receiver, even if you know, the receiver doesn't like it goes into compression, that receiver is seeing nothing except whatever is in the passband of that filter.
Well done. Sounds like a good installation, good healthy installation with that gas discharge for the electromagnetic pulse and the DC return with your shorted quarter wave stub, and then the super filter on the receiver line only. Well done. Sounds like you're very happy with that brick wall filter. Nope, you've got it for the next guy.
Okay, this is KKY. All right, let me look through. Here's one. All right, I don't know if we want to, you know, I guess I can get some kind of answer on this. I bought a Palomar TCM-1 RF current meter at a Hamfest. Palomar used to make this product. Since then, they've gone. They do not provide it anymore. It only gives me some limited information on it. But it basically, it says an RMS, says measures RMS current. Okay, what is RMS current all about? And what exactly is this meter measuring? If I move it along, how does that work? What exactly is this thing? It supposedly has no wires coming out of it. It says it has a built-in sensor. I think I know this product, Dick. For some reason, I remember it some years ago, Dick, over.
Yeah, I think it's very similar. The Palomar one, I think, is very similar to the Hewlett-Packard product, which is a kind of a clamp-on meter, clamp-on current meter. And the one made by Hewlett-Packard, it's got two drawers that open up. You put the piece of wire inside and you close the drawers. And now there's various handheld current meters that people have used over the years that open up like a great big letter Q, and they open up and you put the wire in and close it. Well, this probe that I'm talking about that's on the Hewlett-Packard one goes down to a small fraction of a milliamp. As current flows down a wire, AC or DC current, it must, by Lenz's law, create a circumferential magnetic field. So if you close your hand in the normal way with your thumb, close your fingers with the thumb sticking out in one direction, and make believe you're closing your fingers around a piece of wire, the thumb pointing in one direction could be the current, your fingers curling around the wire represent the magnetic field. And this ferrite-like device in two clamshells that clamps around the wire senses that magnetic field. Built into that ferrite is a Hall effect device. A Hall effect device is a device that measures local magnetic fields and creates a current output, or is it a voltage output, depending on how you look at it, which then is amplified and sent to the meter. So various versions of these things can measure AC current, and the slightly more exotic version can measure DC current. The Hewlett-Packard one can measure DC current. I could, with some difficulty, get you the Hewlett-Packard model number, no longer manufactured, but I own one, very handy device. It goes up to something like 10 amperes and down to something like 0.01 microamperes, something very, very small, lots and lots of range to it. Now, when it comes to DC current, or the average amount of DC current, that's pretty easy to understand. In the case of a mixture of AC and DC, or AC itself, RMS, root mean square, is a mathematical number that represents the heating characteristic. Con Ed, for instance, is supplying you roughly 120 volts RMS into your wall socket of your house. And if you look at that with your oscilloscope, that 120 volts RMS, your oscilloscope will tell you it's got 167 volts of peak, plus peak 167, and 8.5 milliseconds later, minus 167 volts peak. And so, granted the voltage goes as high as 167, but it doesn't dwell there very long. If you took that 120 volt RMS voltage out of your wall socket, and you plug it into a pure resistive device, like an incandescent light bulb, or like a dummy load resistor, and you measure the brightness of the bulb, and you measure the amount of heating of the resistor, you'll find that 120 volts of pure DC or 120 volts of RMS, which is really 167 volts of peak of the sine wave, they both create the exact same amount of heating. So RMS is heating equivalent voltage. And how do you form that? Is you literally take your sine wave, and it doesn't have to be a sine wave. You can measure the RMS of any wave shape in the world, as long as it's a repetitive wave shape. And so you break it up into a whole lot of little pieces. And those whole little pieces are each squared, summed together, and then you take the square root of the result after first dividing by the number of pieces that you added together. That's the RMS process. What's going on there, the reason why you're squaring each little sample of voltage you measure is because we all know that the heating on a resistor is equal to E squared over R. Take whatever voltage you got, say for instance I've got a 10 volt battery going into a 10 ohm resistor. How much heat is there in that resistor? I would square the 10 volts, and I would come up with 100 volts. I'd divide by the resistor of 10, and I'd end up with an answer of 10 watts. So 10 volts into a 10 ohm resistor, E squared over R, creates 10 watts of heating. You could have done it the other way around. You could have said, hey, by Ohm's law, 10 volts into a 10 ohm resistor is going to create a current of 1 ampere. 1 ampere times 10 volts is 10 watts. So you can do it by summing the current, you can do it by squaring the voltage and dividing by the resistance, you can do it by calculating the current, multiplying it by the voltage, and you can also do a similar thing with I squared R. So in either case, heating of voltage is equivalent to voltage squared at each instant of time, and RMS tries to tell you that. So if you ever have somebody told you the peak voltage of a pure sine wave, and you want to convert it to RMS, you can either go through that mathematical process of breaking it up into a whole lot of little chunks, and you're really doing an integration process, or you can say that, hey, it's a pure sine wave, I know the answer is related by square root of 2. So you take the square root of 2, divide it into the peak voltage, and you will get the RMS. Square root of 2 is around 1.414. When it comes to more exotic waveforms, square waveforms with little glitches on them and whatever, the RMS heating value of that waveform is a very good thing to know if you're going into a pure resistance device. If you're going into a power supply, which is going to rectify that voltage, then you have another set of criteria. And there's the next thing you want to know about. I can take 120 volts of RMS current voltage coming from Con Ed, put it into a kind of a computer-rated power supply, and many of them just rectify the input voltage, charge a capacitor to roughly 167 volts, and then put it into some kind of a regulator. I could then go out and buy myself a pure square wave. In the old days, I could buy a pure square wave voltage inverter that takes the 12 volts out of my car battery and gives me a 120 volt square wave. You put that 120 volt square wave into your television set or into your computer, and it'll be happy, unhappy, because it only gets 120 volts onto its capacitor instead of 167. The modern-day UPS devices get around that problem by making a more exotic-looking square wave where the major portion of the square wave is 120 volts, but it's got this little spike in the middle of it of 167. So now you've got the right heating value, and you've got the right voltage peak to charge your simple power supplies that don't have a transformer to them. K2KEY, K2LIW in the tech net.
Hey, very good. This is K2KEY. Okay, really to sum it up then, I say that this meter, I remember that they sold it to Palomar, you use it to measure a long transmission line or an antenna leg or a ground wire current. So I guess, I don't know, could you say there's a vector quantity? Is there a vector quantity to any of this stick over?
Yeah, there's various kinds of RF current meters. In the old days, you would tune your spark transmitter by literally putting a AC-sensitive current meter in series with the wire that went to the antenna, the transmission line that went to the antenna. And in some of those cases, the current created heating. The heating heated a bimetallic strip. The bimetallic strip moved the needle, and it measured current that way. Slightly more modern ones after that there was a real rectifier network in there that rectified the RF current, and it moved a Dawson-Val meter movement. Modern-day current meters don't have to interrupt the wire. They measure the local magnetic field. So the wire stays the way it was as long as you can clamp around one single lead at a time. In the case of your power cord coming from your rig going and plugged into the wall, you've got three wires there altogether. The safety, the hot, and the return. You put a clamp on ammeter around that, you'll measure zero, because the current coming out and the return are identical in magnitude, opposite in direction, and they magnetically cancel. So if you want to measure the current on the wire coming into your, the power cord coming into your rig, by some means you have to separate one of those hot or return and put a clamp on ammeter around it. So almost all modern ammeters really are measuring current. In fact, I own a Sears Roebuck product which allows me to measure up to 400 amperes of the voltage flowing to or from my battery into the starter motor. It's just a simple magnetic vein type meter where you hold this thing near the wire. It clamps onto the wire to hold it at a standard distance. So the main red wire coming out of the battery that goes to the starter motor, you clamp this thing on it, and when the starter motor is running, a magnetic field is created, and these two chunks of steel inside get sucked to each other or repelled from each other, I'm not sure which, and it moves the needle, and the thing reads 0 to 400 amperes. So there's various ways of measuring current in a wire, AC or DC, by measuring the local AC or DC magnetic field that it creates. And the nicest way to do it with modern day instrumentation is clamp-on ferrite device, which has a Hall effect sensor built into it. And I guess it's also possible to build it in such a way that the clamp-on device is really a kind of a toroid where there's another winding somewhere, and the winding acts as a secondary, and it picks up the voltage equivalent to the current that's flowing through the wire that's down the center of this this clamped-on two clamshells of ferrite material. K2KEY, KQRIW.
WB2C, UK.
Mr. C, UK. Hey, Bill, I bet you've used a lot of these things. How do you think they work?
Well, Dick, I haven't had too much exposure to them, but the couple of times I have used the AC ones, they work very well, and it certainly beats having to make an electrical connection into a circuit to measure current. Dick, I have a question to ask you that's sort of unrelated to your current topic, but maybe you could help me out.
When you say the current topic, how do you mean that? Which field are you in? Are you in the magnetic field? Go ahead, Bill.
Well, I got a notice from the village here. They want to put in the radio read water metering system, and I'm wondering what you know about it. I've heard rumors about that they interfere with 2 meters and they create problems. I'm wondering if you know about them, and if there's any way that I can have the town not put it in. Is there any kind of excuse that I could say that my wife suffers from RF interference to her brain or some crazy thing that I could have them not put the meter in? I'd rather not, because in the past I've just sent in a card every once a year to get my water bill. Back to you, Dick.
I don't think you should worry about that device, Bill. I have a device like that. It's a radio-controlled switch that's on my air conditioner that was installed by LIPA, like Loco in those days, and it allows them to remotely control my air conditioner during a brownout day. They can turn off my air conditioner 20 minutes or 40 minutes per hour during a brownout. And it is radio controlled, and I have no trouble with it. I think the chances of you having trouble with that, Bill, are very, very slim. In which case, there's various countermeasures you can use when it occurs. I don't think it's going to occur. When it comes to radio frequency biohazard, and your wife being sensitive to it, that's a very long shot, Bill. And you'd be in violation of the Communication Act of 1996, a minor form of it. Communication Act of 1996 basically states you cannot deny the sighting of a cell phone base station based on a perceived risk of radio frequency biohazard. You can deny the sighting of a cell phone base station because of aesthetics or mechanics or mechanical safety or falling of the hardware or whatever. And the value of the property, there's various ways you can turn it down. But you cannot turn it down for radio frequency biohazard. Well, a cell phone base station runs a huge amount more power than this little radio-controlled device that reads the meter for you automatically. I don't think you should fight it, Bill. I don't think you should be afraid of it. And if at worst you get interference from it, that interference is going to be a burst of energy that lasts 1 or 2 seconds long, and it's going to occur twice per week. I don't think that amount of EMI is going to really...